The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jeff Cohn. I'm the eldest son of the late Natalie Cohn, in whose memory this endowed lecture has been named. The author event series is made possible only through support from caring individuals like you. Please consider making a gift of whatever you're able to and helping the Free Library advance literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity for all Philadelphians. My mom's favorite pastime was reading. She loved the Free Library. She helped people with reading disabilities learn to read, and she especially loved the library for giving access to the great books to everyone for free. It's my sincere privilege to introduce Maisie Hirono to you this evening. Called a hero on the left by the Washington Post for her vocal support of progressive legislation and issues, Maisie K. Hirono is the only immigrant and the first Asian American woman in the United States Senate. Hawaii's junior senator since 2013, she formerly served the Aloha State in the U.S. House of Representatives as its lieutenant governor and as a state representative. At the age of seven, Senator Hirono immigrated with her mother and brother from rural Japan aboard the President Cleveland and crossed the Pacific Ocean to Hawaii, charting her journey from a single room in a Honolulu boarding house to the Washington, D.C. halls of power. Heart of Fire is Senator Hirono's story of resilience, speaking truth to power, and her hard-fought advocacy for the most vulnerable Americans. Her talk tonight will be in conversation with 6 ABC Action News Morning Edition anchor Tamala Edwards. We're so pleased to have them here with us this evening. Maisie and Tam, the screen is yours.
Well, thank you so much. And of course, thank you in memory of your mother. What a wonderful gift and a wonderful legacy. And I really appreciate being part of this. And Senator, thank you so much for the book and for joining us this evening.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. And thank Jeff. See, mothers are very important to us. So yes, we're doing this in her honor, really, too.
And in fact, let's talk about that. I had asked you before we came on screen, what led you, you know, was there an event? And you said it was your mother. And truly, at its heart, the book seems to be a love letter to your mother and the woman she let you be versus the woman she forced you to be by facing up to expectations or limitations.
Truly. The book is dedicated to my mom because she had suffered at that point two strokes and was not able to talk or really converse much. And I thought it is time for me to tell her story. And it is an homage to her. It is dedicated to mom, who changed my life by bringing me to this country. And not very many of us can say one person did that, but my mom did that for me.
And I think a lot of people, they may be aware of you. They look up, they see you on MSNBC or CNN. But until they read this book, they may not realize the trajectory that you truly do bring an immigrant's heart and point of view and knowledge of the struggle in your own backstory. So why don't you start by telling people a little of what they will experience in reading the book?
I am an immigrant. My mother escaped an abusive, troubled marriage to my father, who I never got to know. He turned out to be an alcoholic as well as a compulsive gambler, both things he hid from my mother before he married her. And it was a bad marriage. She's in Japan. Very traditional. She lived with her in-laws who treated her like a slave. And at one point, she just decided that he wasn't going to change. And so she planned in secret, not just to escape herself, which is what one would expect in such a tradition-bound place like Japan, especially at that time, but to figure out a way to bring all of her children to a new country, to start a new life. It took tremendous courage and risk-taking on her part. And she was only 30 when she did that.
In the book, you begin with, she's sick, but there's no room to be sick. She crawls into bed, and before the sun is up, she's out of bed going back to work. When you watch the stories that are on the news, the way we're talking about people at the border, how does your own background influence what you say to people about the way we talk about them?
I never forget where I came from and the humble beginnings of living in a single room in a boarding house. And my mom is working two jobs with absolutely no safety net to take care of us. And we would often run out of money by the end of the month. To see the kind of harmful immigration system that Trump imposed on all of these people, and particularly the childhood separations, it's mindless cruelty, I call it. And so I would like to have our country create a humane immigration system. And that is not what we have now. That's certainly not what Joe Biden inherited. He inherited a shredded, heartless immigration system from Trump. So yes, the immigrant experience is something that I have experienced firsthand, and I bring that to the table when we discuss immigration issues.
And when your senators on the other side say, well, they should follow the rules, what do you say back?
These people are running from a place that is violent. You know, they are not leaving everything they know on a lark. And this is what immigrants do. They leave everything they know to come to a new country where they start off with nothing. And of course, in the case of the Northern Triangle countries, with the huge violence and drugs, we are the consumers of those drugs. Our country bears responsibility also. And so when I say we need a humane immigration system, with particular reference to the Northern Triangle countries, that we need to provide resources to these countries so that they can live a life in their own country that does not expose them to murder, torture, death.
And we will continue to talk a little bit about politics. I want to circle back to your journey in the book. Many people know you now for your blunt comments, but that people may not realize was a trajectory for you. You were always known for being formidable in the beginning. People knew the ice queen when they crossed you, but not necessarily direct. I want you to talk about those two things, Japanese, Hawaiian society, and being reticent, and yet this journey you were on, learning how to speak up.
I grew up in a community, in a culture, a local culture. You know, Hawaiian is a word we use only to refer to Native Hawaiians, but the local culture in Hawaii is not particularly verbal, non-confrontational. We try to work together and be very cooperative. And so verbal, aggressive, confrontational behavior is not particularly rewarded in Hawaii, certainly not coming from a woman. That is the culture that I grew up in. And of course, the Asian culture is really quite reticent and reserved. So I had all of that, and I kind of went through this journey wherein I always stood up for myself, and I was effective as a legislator, but I just didn't have to be so noisy about it until Trump came on the scene. And it became very important to speak out against the biggest bully of them all, who was just about everything he did, he just attacked people. And I decided at one point that I would speak to the national press in a way that I generally didn't like to speak to them, because that's not my comfort zone to be talking to the national press. So I think it came as a surprise to them when I stepped up to the spray, which consisted of media people from press and from magazines and the TV. And they positioned themselves where they can run into us. At the end of the hallway, and I stepped up and I said, Trump is a liar, misogynist, and an admitted sexual predator, and he should resign. And that was it. I think they were surprised. But there was no turning back after I began to become very vocal in a plain-spoken way, though. And I did not do it for the attention, but you're right that I did begin to get feedback from people wherever I went pre-COVID days who would say to me, thank you for speaking plainly the things that I'm thinking. So it certainly reinforced my behavior, but I was pretty much, I had decided that I was going to speak up at that point. And we all have that capacity, by the way, Tamala. Do people call you Tam? Tam.
Just call me Tam.
You might.
Yeah, that's fine.
So we all have that capacity, but most of us are not particularly used to getting out of our narrow, what I would call the comfort zone of behavior. I learned to do that over time, get out of my comfort zone.
And another thing that really struck me about your book is so often in a situation, you were the most competent person, but the men weren't necessarily competent, but they couldn't wait to hold up their hands. It reminded me of something Sheryl Sandberg said in Lean In, that men, if they have 30% of the qualities, think they should be running the joint.
Yes.
And women, if they don't have 90% of the qualities, don't think they should even contemplate it. And it seemed to be a walking case of this.
It is an experience that a lot of women I know have, that men will say, you're not ready, wait your turn. And you begin to question your own capabilities. For women in politics, and certainly in the time that I got into politics, there weren't very many of us, and it took us a long time to feel that we had the wherewithal to run for office ourselves, something that never seems to enter the minds of these guys who just kind of run for office. Women, we're much better prepared as a general rule before we run for office.
Over and over again, when you meet with powerful men, they want to say, Maisie, here's why you shouldn't do it. You should get out of the race. You can't do it. And repeatedly, when they're talking, you're saying that the tape in your head is, well, why don't you shut up and help me? And I thought that was really important because so many women would listen to what they were saying and say, well, you're right. I don't deserve it. Why do you think with everything you were able to have the voice that was refuting them in your head?
I was a very determined person. And so most of the elections that I ran, including for statewide races, I did it without the boys behind me. And I just determined that I was going to do it. And so I did. But that tape runs in all our heads and it does give you pause. But after a while, I just decided if I wait around for them to decide that I was ready, I should live so long. And so I was very determined to make my way in politics. And I had lots of my very loyal group of supporters who believed in me through thick and thin.
And I want you to tell the story of the lay, because it comes early in your career, but it felt like it was a harbinger that you found that even little things can make a difference in what people understand and making your point. So why don't you tell the story?
When I first got elected to the Hawaii State Legislature, we would honor people to come to the legislature, and generally there were men. There weren't that many women who were being honored by the state legislature, by the House. And the expectation was that the tradition in Hawaii is that we give lei to the people we honor, and women give men lei and men give women lei. Since most of the honorees were men, my colleagues would just drop all these lei on our desks with the expectation that when we are honoring the men, we're just supposed to jump up and give the lei. And when one of my colleagues dropped a lei, I said, I don't do that. She said, what do you mean you don't do that? I said, I don't do lei. He said, he looked at me and he took away the lei. Pretty soon it spread that I don't do lei until I think I had made my point. And one of my colleagues said, I think you can stop doing this now because you're now developing a reputation as a hard ass. So you've made your point. And I laughed about it. But then the men began to actually ask us, could you give a lei to so-and-so? And they wouldn't just drop the lei, you know? So point made, I'd say.
You know, sometimes it takes a little thing to make a big point. And in fact, I would imagine you have a lot of young women who come up to you and say, what's your best advice? And I wonder what you say, especially to young Asian American women. And do you see the same cultural strictures for them that you saw for millennial and Gen Z women that you saw coming up in Hawaii, or is it different?
I think for women, there's a lot of sexism in our society in our country, and probably still six-year-old stereotyping, role behavior and expectations placed on us. I'm glad to know that there's probably far less of that with the younger women, and I'm glad, because while I considered myself very self-sufficient, independent, and all of that, you can't escape the expectations of the dominant culture. And so when those things would arise, I'd have to kind of acknowledge that this was happening and then do something about it. And often in a strong but quiet way. It took me a long time to get to this point where I describe it as my more complete self, in that I give voice to when I disagree. And that's something that is not comfortable, especially for Asian women. I have a lot of Asian friends who say, and they're very accomplished and all that, but our culture is not one that encourages us to speak out. And so I hear from a lot of my friends who are Asians who say, I've experienced that. You stop yourself from speaking up, but you know, they need to do more. They recognize that they should speak up, because I do, and nothing horrible happens. I do have my detractors, oh, believe me. I trigger a lot of hate stuff that comes my way, but it doesn't bother me.
I would imagine it's so freeing that you just don't even think about it anymore.
It is.
In the book,
it is a gift to myself that I am able to express myself in the very straightforward, plain way that I do.
In the book, you also get very personal, and you talk about a long-term boyfriend that you were with for 18 years, and it's difficult from the start, and yet you stay, and it takes a marriage proposal before you really tinker within your mind, you know, what am I getting here? And you realize he's never going to treat you the way you should be treated, and that's the end of that. And I wanted to ask about that, because when you look back, why do you think you stayed? Do you look back with regret? And I ask specifically, because what lessons do you want the readers, especially young women, to take from that part of the story?
Sometimes when you're in a relationship that is not particularly positive for yourself, you don't really recognize it, because it's not all bad, you know? And so it has its moments, but the bottom line was that I think the worst thing between this person and myself was that he was very competitive with me. I think that is a very negative aspect of any committed relationship, when the two people are competing. And I didn't compete with him, but he always wanted to make sure that he was seen as a smarter person, and all of that. And I very much was an enabler. I realize that now. And so when I read about how difficult it is for women to leave a relationship that is not good for them, it takes a long time. And I had my ups and downs with him, but also we were together for about 18 years. And the day came when he asked me to marry him, and I contemplated being married to this person for the rest of my life. And that's when I really decided to take stock and cut the ties. Took a long time.
But I thought it was a great story, and I was glad that you included something so personal, because I think women might say, somebody that powerful, it's a journey. It's not overnight.
Yes.
There's a great story in the book that you tell about Alvin Shim and some advice he gives you about using your anger strategically, which that seemed to be a great lesson.
Alvin Shim was often seen as a guru. He was like Yoda to a lot of people. He was very wise. And I was in his law firm, and he kept trying to bring me within his ambit, but I just wouldn't go there. And so one day when I was running for governor, and all these unions that I had been working with and supporting them for years in the state legislature, they decided they weren't going to support me. And some of them even recruited the former Republican chair to become a Democrat to run for governor. And so all of these things were arrayed, and I got so upset. I also had my cadre of people who said, you know, you have to just stop being taken for granted. Because one of these union leaders said, well, you know, Maisie's so fair-minded that even if we don't endorse her, if she gets elected, she won't take it out on us. And so, yes, I was really angry, And I decided that I wasn't going to take the sitting down, that these powerful unions are going to all send their endorsement to somebody else, not me. It's not as though I expected it. It's one of the life lessons learned. Never expect anybody to support you because you've worked with them. That is a pretty strong political lesson to learn, but I got that. Anyhow, so I decided I was going to go in and visit all of, talk with all of the union leaders of the state unions in all the neighbor islands. And I was getting ready to go. Alvin called me up at 9:30 or something. And I hadn't talked to him in a long time. And he just called me out of the blue. But because he had often been the lawyer for all these unions, he had heard rumblings and all that. And he said, I know you're really upset. And I don't blame you. You can go there and raise hell. Or you can really think about why you do what you do. Is it that you want their endorsement? Or is it something else? And he said, you know, I don't expect you to change your mind or anything, but I hope you think about it. And I did think about it. And I realized. So when I went to all of the neighbor islands to visit, to talk with these union leaders on the neighbor islands, particularly one, it was the IOWU, which is the union that represented all the plantation workers at the time. And I told them, I'm not here to drive a wedge between you folks and that your state leadership, but I just want you to know that I will always support your workers. And one of them, the leader, said, I was all ready to vote against you, but you have me thinking. So what happened was all of the units on all the neighbor islands, they actually had to take a vote as to who they would endorse, whereas before it was just top down and they would just go along with whatever the top down decision was, and they all voted. Had to vote. And for the first time ever, these really powerful unions, some of them ended up not endorsing anybody for governor because there was a split within the local unions. I learned a lot from that process, some very valuable lessons, and to reinforce why I actually ran for office. And, you know, I let go of any expectations that people were supposed to come and support me because I had busted my ass for them.
But it sounded like once you figured center what matters to you,
yes,
some good things came from it.
Yes, that was there was power in that. There was such a sincerity and strength in that some of these people who originally voted against me became some of my strongest supporters going forward.
You run for governor at one point and you lose. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated by the fact that the point at the end of the story wasn't that you were devastated, though you were. It was that you listened to your inner voice, that something said, you'll get another shot, the window will open. And instead you decided to enjoy your life rather than sort of focusing on the failure the way so many people would do. And I thought that was fascinating that you had the voice, that you were willing to listen to it and willing to make the most of it.
The reason I wasn't despondent over it, yes, it was the first campaign that I had lost, but it was a big one, was that I had given it everything I had. It was the hardest race I'd ever run, even running for a U.S. House or Senate, the running for governor, because there were just so many things arrayed to contribute to my defeat, that I gave it everything I got. And so what I decided was, along with my husband, who was just totally supportive and not competitive with me, said, take the time to restore yourself. And I did. I had a great time for 3 years until the next opportunity came up. And I was feeling guilty after a while because I said to my husband, you know, I should be bringing home the bacon too. After all, I have a law degree, but I don't want to practice law. So I'm going to go and become a mediator or something. And he said, oh, I don't think you want to do that. But, you know, I just restored myself through art, through reading, through going on trips with my husband where I got to be the non-working spouse for a change. That was really fun. And so it was, I really needed that. I also spent time in Japan. I was asked to speak at a university outside of Tokyo. I spent a month in Japan by myself, which was fantastic. Considering that I have no sense of direction, but I went everywhere on the Tokyo subways and I made my way, and it was a terrific experience doing some of those things during my hiatus from politics.
And I find that that is often something in the lives of people, that sometimes it's the step back that allows you to take the next step forward, rather than really driving yourself into the ground.
That's right.
I wanted to talk to you about a few things going on in the news, because in the book, you talk about trying to have relationships across the aisle. At one point, you need Jeff Sessions, and in a conversation, you literally put your hand on his heart and say, I want you to think with this, and it makes a difference. Or searching out Orrin Hatch and finding points of commonality. Mm-hmm. But we keep hearing that things have gotten so fractured. Is that still possible? Are those relationships still there, or not the way it was when you first walked in 6 years? I mean, even more than 6 years ago.
It's gotten a lot more divisive. And when you have a leader like Mitch McConnell, who said at the outset, I'm going to make sure that Barack Obama is a one-term president, and therefore fought just about everything that President Obama wanted. And so if Mitch McConnell said tomorrow, I will work with the Democrats, we will get things done, we'll pass the infrastructure bill, we'll do all these things, it will happen. There will be the people who will hold out, you know, I would imagine the Ted Cruz's and the Hollies and all those guys. But we could get things done, but he doesn't want to do that. His goal is to take back the Senate. And so, yes, we have a divided situation. However, on the COVID-19 hate crimes bill that I got passed, people were really surprised that it got
I was going to ask you about that. Were you shocked?
That I worked with Susan Collins, and as the bill was percolating, we began to get more bipartisan support for some of the amendments. And so I worked really closely with Susan to create the broader support for the bill while maintaining its purpose. So it can be done. However, I would say on the really big bills that we need to pass, I kind of doubt that Mitch is going to just say, hey, fine, we'll do it.
But I think also what I was getting at was personal relationships. And this comes from my first campaign that I covered a million years ago. I covered Bob Dole, and I'll never forget, he was somewhere and then he watched images flash up on a screen and Teddy Kennedy's face came up. And he said, oh, that's my friend. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine in this day, you know, with things so fractured, that the first thing that would come to mind out of people across the aisle when they mm-hmm. see each other's face is, that's my friend. Do you guys have friendships beyond the politics anymore?
I can't say that I do. I am more than happy to work across the aisle in a pretty transactional way. And also, we don't have families who live in Washington, D.C. The way in the good old days, mm-hmm. the families would be here, the children would be going to the same schools. There were lots of opportunities to get to know each other in a person-to-person way. There are very few of those. So most of the people leave town as soon as we do the last vote, usually on Thursday. And that's it. And so while the women in the Senate would get together pre-COVID to get together and have dinner, we would host, we would take turns. Those would be times when we could get to know each other better, but we haven't done that in a long time. Yeah. I do consider Lisa Murkowski to be someone that I feel warmly toward. So she's a person that I often will work with.
Well, there's hope.
Yes. And she's pretty independent, as you probably saw. She was the only Republican to vote against Kavanaugh.
As you noted in the book.
Yes.
And your bill, the anti-Asian violence bill, were you surprised that it truly sailed through the Senate without the kind of rancor that we've seen with many people debating over whether or not there's actually anti-Asian violence?
We all saw the rise in anti-Asian hate crimes, and thankfully, we have a president who condemned it and not one who stoked the flames by creating an environment where this kind of animus against Asians came to the fore. But that bill, when I first introduced it, I couldn't get a single Republican to co-sponsor it, even if we had made overtures to Republicans. But Chuck Schumer decided that he was going to put it on the fast track because so many of these incidents, as we all saw on TV, were going on in New York. The most recent one was also New York. So he wanted to push this through. And as it percolated, as I mentioned, we began to get more bipartisan support. But when the bill finally came for a vote, there have been over 20 amendments on this bill. And we would have been debating this bill for a long time if we didn't make some kind of a come to an agreement on the amendment. So there were three amendments that we had to defeat. These are all amendments that were intended to basically deep six and derail the bill. Unfortunately, the people who, even the people who proposed the amendments voted for it, except for one, and we won't talk about him.
That's not like you to not talk about
he's
him.
He's an outlier, even within the Republican Party, and that is saying a lot.
You know, when Trump won, some people said it's because he appealed to the worst, but there were others who said it was because he had a way of making people who felt ignored and unseen feel included. And, you know, that's been your natural bailiwick to talk about those who are often in the shadows, who often feel as though they don't have a voice. Do you think that there was some truth to that? Did you recognize it? And did it influence how you counseled your party on how to talk to and reach to people, reach out to people who maybe were persuaded, well, I think he sees me and the Democrats don't?
I think that Trump did appeal to prejudice, fear. I think there was a lot of that to his appeal. He certainly gave voice to all of that. And so these were, you know, what Trump did in his campaign was expose the deep fault lines in our country against the systemic racism that is in our country, and the discriminatory feelings toward the other, and definitely Asian American Pacific Islanders are the perpetual foreigners, that we are the other. And so he appealed to a lot of that. He stoked a lot of that. And really gave voice to a lot of the divisiveness that always existed in our country, but he made it okay for all of so much of that to be exhibited. And I do think that he appealed to a lot of the negative aspects of ourselves. So at the same time, though, I think that it is... And I say at the same time, we now recognize there are vast divisions in our country. And I think that part of how we're going to come together in a truth and reconciliation kind of posture is to do more that will support the people who are not getting much help from government, who don't expect help from government, but who Trump appealed to because he was seen as the outsider saying, you know, to heck with government. And so when government can do those things that will truly help people, I think they will begin to think, well, maybe government can do some things. I mean, it's not the be all and end all answer to everybody's troubles, but I think that's part of what my hope is for our country's healing.
Let me ask you that question in a different way. When you would go home and you would talk to your constituents, I would imagine you had some people who said, I voted for Trump. Was there anybody who in the conversation with them for why, that it was beyond the ugly, but things that made you think or think about things in a different way?
There were not very many opportunities where I would actually sit and talk with people about why they voted for Trump. There were a lot of people who voted for him because they believe that he was the outsider and was going to, they liked that. And so these were not people who were, I mean, there were a lot of people with wealth who supported him. And so there were a lot of educated people. There were all kinds of people who that he appealed to in different ways. But I think he spoke to them in a pretty visceral way. He spoke to them, not their heads, but in their feelings, in their hearts. And that is what I believe we Democrats have to do. And that's what I seek to do. When I talk, I want to speak to the hearts and not intellectualize everything. I think the Democrats are really good at marshaling all the facts. I mean, yes, we do need to deal with facts, but I think I've said that we need to speak very plainly to people's hearts. And that's what I did when I went to talk with Jeff Sessions on the bill that I was trying to push through. He and I disagree on everything because I know that. But I just looked at him and I said, I'm appealing to this. And it was his heart. And he just stopped and looked at me. I am sure nobody ever did that with him, but I was very sincere in it. And so, you know, I got through to him. We don't have that many opportunities to do it because I can't have the kind of conversations with my Republican colleagues, truthfully, where I say to them, how is it that you could vote not to hold this guy responsible for not doing more on this pandemic and you have over 500,000 dead? How is it you can vote like that to kick off millions of people from healthcare when you tried to get rid of the Affordable Care Act? How do you not hold him responsible for inciting an insurrection? Those are not very fruitful conversations that I'm going to be having with my Republican colleagues. So I am quite transactional with them.
Focused on what can we get done here? Because you don't expect a good answer.
Common issue. And so I do work with my Republican colleagues on those things that we share a common perspective.
You know, we talked a little bit about the courts, they're taking up a gun rights case, but you know, there are a lot of different things coming. And in your book, you talk about Mitch McConnell saying, you know, everything else is transitory. The courts are where the action really is. And now you're looking at a 6-3 situation. What are your predictions for what you expect to see out of the court in the next matter of years? And is there anything you can do as a senator in reaction to it? Or this is just what we have.
There's a 6-3 conservative majority in the court. That didn't happen by chance. There are groups with dark money, Federal Society people who have their own agenda, and they set in motion a long time ago to place these very ideologically driven judges with lifetime appointments throughout our judiciary. There are over 200 of them, of Trump appointees, a lot of them not even qualified, with hardly any experience, all there for life. So what's going to happen is with the 63 majority, there will be many more cases fast tracked to the Supreme Court on the gun issues to make it much harder for states to impose any kind of gun legislation that would create more safety for people. There will probably be attacks on LGBTQ rights, because two of our Supreme Court justices, Alito and Thomas, have already signaled that they would like to revisit Obergefell, which is the Supreme Court case that authorized gay marriages. You will have lots of cases going straight to the Supreme Court on a woman's right to choose, because there are hundreds of legislation doing that in the state legislatures. You will have voting rights cases that will be going to the Supreme Court, because all of these interests think they now have a chance at limiting our right to vote, limiting a woman's right to choose, limiting LGBTQ protections. You name it, they're going to use the courts for their ideological ends. And it's a huge, huge danger for our country and equal protection, equal rights, justice for all.
Is there anything you're able to do as a senator now that you've laid out for people how dire it is? What is able to be done?
One thing is that the people need to elect those folks who will vote the way that reflects our values, which is to truly care for each other. And the things that I talk about, equal protection, equal justice, equal opportunity, those are important values. And I hope that they will be voting in people who share those values, who will vote that way. The other is from an institutional standpoint, I am for reforming the Supreme Court. And that could be by adding more justices, by cycling circuit court judges through the Supreme Court, by possibly putting in some term limits, because I don't know why anybody should get lifetime appointments to anything. That won't affect the current justices, but one must think long-term. I also think that strong ethics laws and conflict of interest provisions should apply to Supreme Court justices, which they do not.
It doesn't seem as though the speaker or the president is truly, even though they're willing to study it, it doesn't sound like they're truly open to doing any of that.
Then we're going to see, as I said, a lot more cases that all of these limiting kinds of cases that are being fast-tracked to the Supreme Court, you're going to see them upheld.
There are a couple of contentious issues that are in the public viewfinder right now, police reform and voting rights. Do you think that Joe Biden will actually see a bill on either one of these things cross his desk?
I don't think either one of these will happen to in the way that we need them to happen unless we change the filibuster. So that's what the, I think that's what's going to happen, because Mitch McConnell is not interested in helping Joe Biden achieve any of those things. So in order to, he will be an obstructionist. As I said, he can tomorrow say, we will work on these issues with the Democrats. And if he's operating in good faith and not just spending a lot of time, you know, making us spin our wheels, at the end of which none of them votes for the legislation. We've learned from the past not to have that happen. If the Republicans are obstructing all of these major legislations, then the Democrats have got to come to the conclusion, which some of us already have, that we should get rid of the filibuster.
It would be interesting to see if that could actually happen, mm-hmm. and if you could get Joe Biden persuaded on that. I want to go to a question or two that has now come in from the audience. And the first one says, would you talk about the differences, if any, you saw between Japanese-American women in Hawaii and Japanese-American women in the lower 48? Was the culture different or pretty much the same?
As a generalization, the Japanese culture is one where there's a reticence. We're very reserved. I think that the Japanese-American community on the mainland really suffered from a lot more overt discrimination, clearly in World War II. If you read the news articles, and all of these are horrible depictions of Japanese Americans. And yet so many of the people who have been interned, they never talked about it, because there's also this Japanese idea called gaman, where you just basically bear it. You suck it up, you bear it, it's called gaman. And so there's a lot of that in both the Hawaii culture as well as the mainland culture. But I know that the mainland AAPI community has had to withstand a lot more overt racism than we in Hawaii. And I'm grateful for that. But I certainly understand that that is going on. And so there are differences, and yet there are some common kind of stereotype expectations. The Japanese women were, you know, quiet and docile and all that kind of BS.
Well, that leads to this next question. Does it amuse you that your naysayers are doubly frustrated by how you tell it like it is in such a melodious, even tone?
I have my detractors. I trigger a lot of hatred and everything else, but it doesn't bother me, because I am speaking in a very plain way to get my points across. And so that's it. I don't sugarcoat things. I call the president a liar. I don't say he stretches the truth. No, he is lying. Or when Bill Barr came before our committee, I said, you lied. You should resign. And so it is very freeing to be able to speak plainly, but I also don't just shoot from the hip, because as a Democrat, I need to have my facts arrayed. So I know what I'm talking about. I have my facts, but then I don't script how I'm going to communicate. I think it's really important to speak very plainly, because people tell me that they really appreciate the fact that I just kind of say what it is that I want to say, and it resonates with them.
And the public does indeed seem to be hungry for that. Do you think we'll ever see an Asian American president?
You never know. I'd like to see a woman become president. And I think the knives are already out for Kamala Harris. I'm happy that, you know, I think it's wonderful that she is the very first female vice president in the entire history of our country. Mm-hmm. But I think that there are going to be all kinds of as I say, the knives are already out to get her. I would love to see, I think we're going to see a lot more minority people running for offices at all levels. And I'm really gratified to see how many AAPI people have gotten elected to the U.S. House. And for a long time, I was the only Asian woman, minority woman in the Senate, until Kamala came and Tammy Duckworth came and Catherine Cortez Masto. We need to get the minority women, particularly, into the pipeline, minority people into the pipeline at all levels. And then we will see more of them run for statewide office and the national offices, and eventually the president.
And it does make a difference. I mean, I think, you know, when I was a child growing up, it was a bunch of guys who all pretty much looked interchangeable. And then when it changes, you're like, why was that such a big deal? You know, it really, it's America.
Yes.
Somebody had a question about your family and they wanted you to share a memory of your mother that puts a smile on your face, and they say aloha. So I'm assuming it's somebody from Hawaii. Oh. And somebody also said, would you share some of the wisdom from your mother that you turn to for solace and support? So tell us about a memory and tell us about a bit of wisdom.
My mom lived with me and my husband for over 20 years. And she just did all kinds of things that, like, she would peel an orange for my husband every single day and leave it in the refrigerator. So every time he eats an orange, he thinks of my mom. That's just one small thing. Her wisdom, she was very strong, a very determined person. And I learned from that. So her heart of fire, I think some of that is in me. And she totally supported me, by the way. She was very unusual in that she never once asked me when I was going to get married or when I was going to have children. Not once. And I asked her one time why not? And she said, look, she basically ruined her life by getting married to my father. And why should I tell you what to do? You will make your own way. I trust you.
A remarkable woman, truly. And that made me wonder, like, you talked about going back to Japan for the month. Did you ever go back and find your father's family to say, Laura Sato was fine and look at us now?
No way. I would consider that a betrayal of my mother, because I have no idea what my father looked like or anything. She totally cut ties. That part of my family doesn't exist for me. And it would be a betrayal of my mother to think otherwise. And the way I look at it is all of my strengths came from her. And I do have some bad aspects to my personality, I would say. And those all had to have come from his side of the family.
Well, I'm sort of surprised none of them have tried to reach out to you, have tried to make that bridge.
There was a time when my father's sister wrote to somebody, I guess my mother eventually, and said that my grandmother on my father's side, who was really mean to my mother, saw an article about me because I'm in politics in Hawaii, and cried. And I said to my mom, what do you, do you want to reply? She said, no. When I put the thousands of miles between us, that's it. That is how determined my mother was. And it wouldn't even occur to me that I would do anything to try to find my father's side of the family. And that may sound weird or cruel, but, I have enough friends, and I have people that I care about that I wish to spend time with.
Somebody has written a question, and it's a long one, but I think it's an important one to get into and hear your perspective. It said, I'm concerned about the lack of security in our elections. Rob Wyden has introduced the SAFE Act with a number of safeguards on voting equipment and mandatory audits. However, these safeguards seem to be left out of HR 1 and aren't discussed. I'm concerned about the ability to verify elections. Trump and his kind seem to have hijacked this issue with ill intent, but it's important. Before I sort of dig through parts of that, I'm going to just let you comment on the question as it was presented.
The best way to have secure elections is to make sure we have paper ballots. And not every state, in fact, some states have done away with paper ballots. Why? Because you actually have a trail. Because election systems, you can hack it. It may not be that easy, although I think it's relatively easy. So you have to have paper ballots. And I would want that to be, we have bills to do that. And you think the Republicans support that? No way.
You know, when we talk about the issue, and that's why I wanted you to answer the question as it was, before I start to ask about parts of it, because when somebody says, I'm concerned about the lack of security in our elections, election officials, Republican and Democrat, secretaries of state in both party, and including in the Trump administration, said this was the most secure election ever.
Yes.
And so what are we to do with this continuing idea, this question that there's a lack of security in our elections? Is it enough to say there's no evidence there? Or if it exists long enough, do you have to address it? Do you have to do things to sort of support it? What is the right thing to do?
if the questioner is asking whether our election machines are secure, that's like a cyber attack. That's different from election fraud, which is the big lie that Trump perpetuated. And there is little evidence, billions and billions of votes cast, very little evidence of election fraud. And yet that is the excuse that dozens of states are using to consider hundreds of voter suppression laws that is intended basically to steal the votes by making it a lot harder for minorities and particularly the Black community to vote. So any argument that says we have massive election fraud, that is a big lie. If we're talking about the security of our machines, I think that if the Russians wanted to tamper with our machines, they probably could have, after all, solar winds and all of that. But now this is why it's important to have paper ballots as backups.
Do you think it's worth it at this point to create a voting commission to look at these issues, even if there's no underpinning? Do you think it would be wise to do that, to say, look, we truly investigated it? Or do you think no matter what you do, people will not be satisfied?
Even Attorney General Barr, who often acted like he was Trump's own attorney, they investigated and they found no fraud. There have been all kinds of investigations and tracking over time. There's no massive election fraud going on in our country. Some people want to create a commission. What for? You know, really. So let us try and focus on evidence and facts to make decisions about what we should be doing. It is a fact that we have systemic racism in our country. It is a fact that we have disparate policing in our country. And I'm glad that we now have an attorney general who is opening pattern or practice investigations into some of these police practices, something that the Trump administration they didn't conduct a single investigation. You talk about investigating, how about investigating something that actually is an issue and a problem in our country?
Someone asked you, what are the next sets of things that you intend to focus on in terms of bills that you're going to author?
I'm going to do everything I can to help Joe Biden get our economy back on track, people back to work, reopen our schools safely. And we now have a president who took responsibility for getting this pandemic under control, as opposed to lying about it from the very beginning. Over 500,000 people dying. So I am going to do everything I can to help Joe Biden get the infrastructure bill passed that will create jobs and long-term benefits. I will pay attention to his desire to support the care economy. That would mean to enable women, millions of whom have had to leave their jobs because of the pandemic, to enable them to get back to work through the kind of support that they need for childcare. There's a whole array of things that we can do, and I want to do that to enable our economy to get back on track safely, and to vaccinate as many people as we can. And it is amazing that there's a high percentage of Trump supporters who refuse to be vaccinated.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because in the book you talk about the Vietnam War and how struck you were. I think some publication had pictures, thumbnail pictures of everybody who died on a single day. And it was just crushing. You know, in that conflict, we lost some 50,000 people. We're talking 10 times that number. And sometimes it feels as though it makes very little impact compared to the impact of the death in the Vietnam War. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. The Vietnam War was one that there were massive protests against it. Now, COVID is a pandemic. It is a virus. We have leaders who refuse to acknowledge it, refuse to to encourage their people to get vaccinated so that we can be act like we actually care about other people, and to politicize a virus. That is so crazy to me, to politicize wearing of masks and other safety precautions. So I don't have the answers to that. You know, everybody I know has been affected by this pandemic. For example, I couldn't visit my mother for over a year. So many families have endured that heartache of not being able to see their loved ones. I could only wave to her from the window. And many people know people who have died from the pandemic, or the people who tested positive who will have, who knows, long-term problems as a result. So we have a lot of people who actually cared about what was happening to our country, but the president did not care. So it makes a huge difference who the president is and what he or she cares about and articulates.
As we get to the end here, the last question, it's one that I wrote out. I wondered if when I spoke to Justice Sotomayor, she'd already written a middle school level book, and then she created a children's book. Do you have any interest in turning your book into a children's book for little Asian American boys and girls who, you know, may be wondering, is there, and not just for them, for every child who is wondering, is there a place for them at the table? The same questions you had when you were a little kid eating, what did you say it was? Pistachios and dried squid with your feet hanging out of a tree.
Sitting in the tree all by myself reading a book. I would love to do that. And Sonia Sotomayor is a wonderful storyteller, and her book, I thought if I could write a book like her first book, I would be gratified. And I hope that there are many aspects to my story that people can relate to. Certainly women who have been told pretty much, you know, you can't do it, wait your turn, all of that. Asian women who are not comfortable with vocalizing or speaking up. People who have cancer, who have had to face that trauma, trauma of separation. I hope there are a lot of parts to my story that that are relatable to people, and for children who feel like an outsider. Sure.
And maybe one day they'll be called Senator. And thank of course. You, Senator. I really do appreciate you spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a delight. And to everyone who's participating, you know, I say to all of you, take care, stay safe, be kind.
All right. And on that,
aloha.
Aloha. We'll let that be the last word. Thank you again, Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.